If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
Wine's been in my blood a long time. My parents actually started me early, and I think today, if I were to say this when I was young, they might actually be accused of child abuse of some sort. But
that's so funny, because my vineyard manager over in Sonoma once told me that if I ran into a bear, I had to throw my arms in the air, and if I ran into a cougar, then I had to roll and play dead. And then I thought, well, isn't it supposed to be the other way? And he said, oh, yes. I said, will you try to kill me?
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 526. This week we feature Rob Campbell, founder and winemaker at Maye Wines, El Dorado Hills, California. The name of this winery is pronounced Maye, and the meaning of the word is Native American for bird. Our guest on this podcast is Rob Campbell, founder and winemaker at Maye, which can be found in El Dorado Hills, California. Winemaking is an ancient art practiced by cultures all over the world. The beauty in the wine is climate, soil, tradition, terrain, and people. All people. You can also hear Rob on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term délestage. I'm here with Rob Campbell, and Rob is the owner of Maye Wines. And how are you today, Rob?
I'm doing great.
Where is Maye Wines located?
Well, Maye Wines, I currently make all the wine at my old winery, Story Winery, up in the Sierra foothills. But we source grapes from two regions in California, Sierra foothills and Sonoma County. So Sierra foothills, I've been making wine up there with my father-in-law for, I just celebrated my 31st vintage.
Wow.
But my family all originates from Sonoma County, and I plan to move back to Sonoma County here in the next year or two. So it's kind of an homage to where I've kind of learned how to make wine and the expertise of making Sierra Foothill wines, but also sourcing some grapes back from my ancestral homelands.
Yeah, and speaking of ancestral, obviously you have this connection to being Native American.
So I'm a member of the Federated Indians of Grayton Rancheria, which is a combination of Coast Miwok and Southern Pomo peoples. So the ancestral lands of Coast Miwok are all of Marin County and Southern Sonoma, and the Pomo, again, Southern Pomo, which would be all Sonoma County.
It's a really interesting connection. I can't say off the top of my head there's many that I know of Native American wineries.
No, there's very few Native American wineries, and even fewer Native American winemakers. So I'm a little bit of an oddball in that not only am I a winemaker, I actually own my own brand as well. Well, the other thing too is a lot of people don't realize the actual first winemakers in California were all Native Americans. So at each of the missions, once the mission vineyards were established and the winemakers that had come up from Mexico had trained the local inhabitants, they would just take those skilled winemakers and move them to the next mission to start making Sacramento wine as they went from mission to mission to mission. So of the 21 missions, 17 actually produced wine. And I actually descend from Mission Indians, and three of those missions actually produced wine that my family was at. So I don't have actual documented proof that they were winemakers, but if they were men and they were attached to a mission that had vineyards, pretty much they were working those vines at some point.
Well, hopefully they were able to enjoy some of the wine somewhere along the process.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Completely forbidden.
Yeah. I was afraid to hear you say that. But nevertheless, I think this is very cool. And your background is represented on your labels by these various different birds. Tell me about them.
So the brand is Maye, which in Coast Miwok just means birds. And when I was originally coming up with the idea of this brand and trying to come up with a name, the first wine I produced was the Zinfandel, and its name is Plotchuck. Now, every marketing expert I would ever ask about this would tell me, do not name a wine Plotchuck. That is like a mouthful. But I had this idea of a woodpecker putting an acorn into a knotted piece of wood. And acorns are very important to California Native Americans. So that was kind of the kernel of my thought of what I was going to do. But I do a very specific aging thing with most Maye wines, in that the first Zinfandel was hand-picked. It was brought from these different lots that were being used for these other Zinfandels. So right as they were being blended and made for bottling, I would take the best lots and put them back into neutral oak for 6 more months. And that special blend became the Palatschak Zinfandel blend. And so those wines spend 2 years in oak, the last 6 months in all neutral, and then they're glass aged for at least 3 to 5 years before they're even released.
That's a long time for Zinfandel.
It is, and it's, you know, now the other winemaking experts would tell me, how can you make any money by doing any of this? And I tell them that, number one, is I make wine for my friends. And it's wine that me and my wife enjoy, and I know that my friends will enjoy. And I named it Palatschak because I wanted to represent the language. Coast Miwok language was almost extinct until our tribe was re-recognized in 2000. And my mom was a huge influence in trying to get the tribe's language restored. So being around her and seeing all of this language restoration effort she was doing, I thought, maybe I can do my part. So I named the brand Maye, and each of the labels represent the native word for that bird. Hmm. So for example, the Rhone blend that I do, the Chateauneuf du Pape style wine I do, is called Chocotoc, and that's the California quail. The brown pelican is Omai, and I do a Chardonnay that's called Kalupi.
I think it's a great idea. For my own 2 cents, I in the last few years have become a bit more of a bird fan than I ever was. So there's a fascination in learning about the different birds and their lives because they're really interesting critters.
They are. And each of those birds are native to the area from where I pull the grapes.
Oh, nice.
You'll never see, I don't know, a parrot on one of my on one of my bottles.
Only if you're repeating something. No, that was not even worth saying. Oh, God, that was just plain awful. Yes, thank you. But it's a nice tribute to what you are, to your background, and obviously to your family as well. How many? What is your production? How many cases are you making?
I just had to ramp up recently, so I'm up to about 800 cases. Now, it sounds like a tiny amount. I'm still an executive winemaker at another winery where I make thousands of cases. But for this brand is strictly allocation-based. So I only allocate a certain amount to direct to folks and then distribute to select restaurants around the country.
Is there any retail at all?
There is once you sign up on the list.
Ah, okay. That's fair. You know, to me and to our listeners, this is the kind of thing that we look for, small production. How long have you been a winemaker? How long have you been working in wine?
So I kind of stumbled into the wine business. I like to say I married into the wine business. My wife, who wasn't my wife at the time, I had just started dating her. Her folks took a risk and decided to throw caution to the wind and buy a winery in 1992. And to my mother-in-law's credit, this is her quote, not mine. She says, "We thought we knew a lot about the winemaking, and once we had a winery, we realized all we knew how to do was drink it." So they had to learn everything from the ground up, and me and my wife were there pretty much all the time, especially through the first 5-6 vintages. And so I learned how to make wine shoulder to shoulder with my father-in-law, just helping him see how he was doing. And my father-in-law was a maverick making wines. His name was Bruce Tischner, and this was at Story Winery. And he was doing things with Zinfandel nobody else was doing, or he was just going crazy and trying all sorts of different things. But he developed a knack for really being passionate about each variety's characteristics. He wasn't trying to copy anybody. He basically wrote his own script. And so I think a little bit of that stayed with me. And then in 2011, his health started to fail. So I came back to the winery to help prepare it to be sold.
Hmm.
But in 2011 was probably the absolute worst time to try and sell a winery. It was after the recession had really hit, and it was really rock bottom, and there was this horrible stories in the wine industry of people losing everything. So I took a look around, realized that a lot of stuff was broken. A lot of the wine quality had really fallen off a cliff. So I spent time trying to build back the brand and get it back to being one of the premier producers in the Sierra foothills. And then we sold it in 2019. But in 2014, I was counseled on, I didn't really have a Ferrari. You know, I was making about 13 different wines at that point. But I had some consultants come in. It's like, you don't have that really high-end bottle. Everything's kind of, you know, they're all good. It's just they're all kind of at the same tier. Do you have anything you've been working on that you could do that? And I said, well, it's funny you should ask. I was starting to do a barrel select program with the Zinfandel. And I was, because we had done, we do seven different Zinfandels, you know, 5,000 cases and seven different Zinfandels.
That's a lot.
We got a lot to choose from. So I went through and I found the best barrels of the best lots. And he said, well, do something with that. And that's how Palachok was born. So I didn't even know it was going to be Palachok. I didn't know about Meillet. It was just going to be this high-end Zinfandel that I was doing for Story. But then when we went to sell the winery, I decided to keep the 5 years of production I had already done separate from the sale. And that was the cornerstone for Meillet's launch.
So Story was actually sold in the end then?
Yes, it was.
Okay, got it.
But I got sold with it. So yeah. I'm still the executive winemaker there.
Oh, okay. So you're making the wine there.
Yeah. Alongside the Story wine.
And where's that facility at?
That's in Shenandoah Valley in Amador County.
Nice. Very good. It's interesting, as you mentioned before, both that particular area, the Sierra Foothills, as well as Sonoma. Interesting contrast. Have you considered moving out beyond those areas? I don't mean physically, but in terms of grapes you'd bring in.
I'm going to try and just really stick to the Sierra Foothills and Sonoma County. And probably once I move down to Sonoma County, I'll probably stick strictly with Sonoma County fruit. But still, there's one wine that I do, the Chocotoc, which is my interpretation of Chateauneuf du Pape. Now, in California, you hear everybody talk about GSMs and GSPs, but they're done a certain way, kind of a very California way. I decided to go back and really study Chateauneuf du Pape's, how they're made, how the different lots are made, how the blending techniques are done. It was really fun research. And at the end, I kind of came up with what I wanted to target. And I feel that the Rhone varieties from the Sierra foothills are much more true to their nature of the French style than the Rhone varieties that are grown, say, down in Paso or in Sonoma or in Napa. They just have a much more minerality to them, a little bit leaner. Of course, you do get the Sierra foothill climate, so they can be very high in alcohol. So it's kind of tempering all of that, but producing these well-blended wines that taste definitely more European than they do California.
I want to go down a little rabbit hole here for a minute about the word minerality. Mm-hmm. Some people I've talked to have had kind of an issue with that word. Mm-hmm. Understanding it, getting the public to understand it. I talked to a person who is as we call him, a dirt doctor, who just kind of doesn't dig the word. Mm-hmm. No pun intended.
Right.
Sorry. How would you define that to the average wine drinker?
When I'm thinking about minerality, I'm always kind of referring to soil types. But to back up a step, in California, compared to European wines, we tend to be very highly fruit extracted. Definitely much more fruit forward, much more explosive fruit flavors in the palate. To me, minerality is more of a texture. The words you'll hear a lot are graphite, or pencil lead. And what it is not so much as much of a taste as it is a feel. So when you have the wine on your palate, a lot of times, especially with over-extracted Cabernets that are super fruit forward, you lose a lot of character. And what the minerality to me does is it brings that character back, almost like you're tasting something that was grown in rocky soil. Mm. So you've got that graphite or you have that pencil lead. And it helps with the tannin structures as well, where you kind of feel the tannins, but they're not gripping onto your tongue. You just feel them laying there. And again, it's just giving you more character in a wine.
Good. That's a good description. I think anybody coming into a tasting room hears words that they want to be hip to. This is why we do the Vino Lingo segment of the podcast. But as always, hearing it from a winemaker makes a great deal more sense. So good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, we were talking about, I'm going to go back to this one more time, the varietals that you are making. Mm. And while you say you're sticking with the areas you're working with, are you looking at different varietals at all in the future?
Well, you know, a true Chateauneuf du Pape, there's 17 different varieties to choose from in French legal terms. But here in California, most people stick with Grenache, Syrah, and Mourvèdre. I use Grenache, Syrah, Petite Syrah, Mourvèdre, Cunoise, and sometimes Zinfandel. And all those grow extremely well in the Sierra foothills. It's above a certain elevation. So to get back to that minerality, where I pull the Syrah from is not in the Shenandoah Valley of Amador County, which is where we're located, but I actually pull it from central Amador County at about 3,000 feet, which is pure volcanic soil. So the Syrah at 3,000 feet versus the Syrah in the Shenandoah Valley, which is primarily called as decomposed granite, but we call it Sierra soil, the Syrahs don't taste anything close. Even if you're on the same rootstock and the same clones, they don't taste similar at all. The Syrah down in the Shenandoah Valley is a little bit more washed out, a little bit, again, that fruit balm without any character to it. But the higher elevation, a little bit more stress, that volcanic soil makes total difference.
I think people who've not tried wines from Amador County need to, because it's like anything else, opening yourself up to what's out there. There are really some exceptional wines out there.
Sierra, in the Shenandoah, well, the whole Sierra range, we can pretty much grow anything. The three varieties we tend not to grow up there are Cabernet, Pinot, and Chardonnay. And the reason for that is we have a very short, intense growing season. It's only about between 100 to 120 days between bloom and actual harvest. So it's very quick, it's very hot, it's very intense. So anything that needs long growing seasons or needs extended aging hang time is not going to do well in the Sierra foothills, which happens to be Chardonnay, Cabernet, and Pinot Noir.
Well, I think there's plenty of that made down here, so I think you're in good shape doing
exactly.
That.
But the other 1,000 varieties that exist in the world all do exceptionally well at Sierra foothill.
Well, I'm going to have you step away from California for a minute. You know, here in the States, virtually everybody's making wines. Is there any area that you've tasted that has surprised you that you think is an up-and-coming wine district?
Well, if we want to go way out of the envelope, I have a friend of mine who's asking me to consult on a project in Cambodia.
That's a little out of the neighborhood.
And I said, is anybody actually making wine there? And the answer is yes, there is a winery there at a much higher elevation, so a much cooler climate, but they actually do get enough variance in their temperature to have Vitis vinifera grapes actually form fruit. So that really intrigued me.
Yeah, I'll bet.
That's not one place I would think you could grow grapes.
I wouldn't think so. What kind of elevation are they talking about?
It's about 3,000 feet.
Yeah, that's up there.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certainly people here in the United States growing at higher altitudes, but right. not a lot. But
right. And in Hawaii would be probably the closest equivalent. Those vineyards on Maui are probably about 3,000 feet.
Yeah, sure. And that's obviously volcanic.
Right.
And I would think, although I've not seen any Hawaiian wine, which is even hard to say.
Exactly.
It's going downhill now. Sorry.
That would be the next challenge, make good wine in Hawaii.
Yeah. Well, you know, I asked this question of many of my winemakers simply because there are other areas in the state specifically that are growing some pretty amazing wines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there you go. Who's your hero? Who's the person that influenced you the most?
As a winemaker, huh?
As a winemaker.
I have to say Heidi Barrett, and the reason for that was when I took over the winery and looked at the competitive nature of what we're doing up in the Sierra foothills and where we were located and how much money we had, because we were just a family-run winery. We didn't have tons of money to do advertising, or you know, we didn't have millions of dollars to drop on redoing our tasting room and creating an experience. And so I'd kind of done all the financial analysis and everything, and I realized we really need to differentiate ourselves with our winemaking. We need to be making wine head and shoulders above everybody else because we're 2 miles off the main road.
Mm. Oh.
You have to pass by 21 wineries to get to us from the little town of Plymouth. So what's going to make people drive all the way out to us? Other than some like multi-million dollar tasting room experience thing. And so I said, I need to become the screaming eagle of Amador County. And so I've drawn a lot of, not influence, but I've tried to figure out what does it take to make wine that's just so head and shoulders above everybody else, and it's apparent from the first sip. And I seem to keep going back to a lot of her wineries and a lot of her projects, because she was kind of the first to be doing a lot of that. There's a lot of great winemakers in California, and there's a lot of great wine being made everywhere in California, not just in Napa Valley. And I think it's a discredit to everybody to just focus on certain winemakers, but when they're the first, and she was a woman, so she had that extra challenge, I think she's a huge, huge influence.
She's a fantastic winemaker, and to the point of women in the industry, it's grown so much, it's become less man-dominated business, and I see that as a very positive thing, because I've had wines made by women as well that are like, wow, this is great.
Right. In fact, two of my friends' wineries here in Napa Valley, at Joseph Phelps and at Cake Bread, both of those are female winemakers.
That's right, yeah. So it's impressive, and it's good the doors have opened, because it's important. And I'm sorry if I asked this question right, I don't think I did. Do you own vineyards at all?
No. So I source all my fruit. I purchase all my fruit from other vineyards, except I'm very picky about where I get my fruit from. So
I'd like to think that's a good thing.
Yeah. So in Sonoma, I work with the San Giacomo family.
Oh, nice.
And I've been working with them for a decade now. With Story, and I've developed my own contracts with them. And what I love about the San Giacomos is not only are they expert farmers, but they are just such a great family to work with. And that's what this industry is all about, is personal relationships and really establishing and honoring those relationships. So in return, they have given me access to vineyards I probably shouldn't have access to, because I guess we like each other. But that fruit is usually sold off to other wineries that are charging twice as much for their wine as I charge for mine. And so I have fantastic fruit sources. Up in the Shenandoah Valley, it's a similar situation. I have access to some of the most premier vineyards in the Sierra foothills. And I think that's kind of the hallmark of Meillet Wines, is we only source from premier vineyards, vineyards that people are on waiting lists to get fruit from. And I feel very fortunate I'm in that situation, and I hope I, you know, pay homage to those guys, and the wines reflect how good that fruit really is.
And it's fun to work with that kind of fruit, isn't it?
It is. As San Giacomo, the Pinot that comes in from San Giacomo, is every time it comes into the winery, we always know, like my crush crew always knows, because the fruit literally comes in like you just went and bought the clusters at the grocery store. Every cluster is perfect. There's not one leaf. There's not one thing that's not a grape in those macro bins. And every grape is all uniform in size and color. It's just, I don't know how they do it, but it's fabulous.
Must be an Italian thing.
There you go.
I'm going down a path I'm not super familiar with, but I understand there's a restaurant in Minneapolis, Native American. Your wines are there. Tell me about that.
It's called the Awamni Cafe, and it was created by the sous chef. And what they do there is they only use food ingredients on the menu that are aboriginal to the area that the native Sioux would have used. However, Chef has done an amazing job of turning that into Michelin-grade food. So they actually just won the James Beard Award for the best new restaurant in the United States. So this is Haute Cuisine. Of course, yes, there's a lot of bison and there's a lot of deer, but the big thing is corn. So he uses a lot of corn-based processes where they have used lime to remove the husks. So he will put it into paste. He will do lots of very interesting things. The presentation is off the chart. But what's unique about the Ahwahnee Cafe is it's 100% native-owned. It's 100% native-staffed. So all the chefs are native. All the servers are native. And he's really done this great job of trying to partner with native food producers and native, well, in my case, native wine producer to have a curated menu of native foods, but of the standards of Michelin grade restaurants.
That would be a place to visit for sure. And the name of the cafe again?
Ahwahnee Cafe. They pour our Chardonnay and our Pinot Noir there.
Nice. And it's appropriate they're there.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, I come to the part in the interview where I ask my favorite question. You could take a moment or so to think about it. Mm. And that would be, I'm sure you've done more than your share of media. You get to talk to the press from time to time. What's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
I've never been asked. Well, here's an interesting one. You're Native American and there is kind of a taboo against drinking in Native American communities. So how do you juxtapose the wine production with this perception of alcohol being taboo in Native communities? And what I've told people is, yes, alcohol is taboo in Native communities because it's not been a great thing for Native communities. But this idea that Natives are more susceptible to alcoholism or more susceptible to alcohol abuse is, I think, a misnomer. Because when you have a population that's been dispossessed of land, has been dispossessed of rights, has been, in the case of California, genocide, when you're at the lowest rungs of society, you're going to try and do anything to escape your reality as possible. And that will drive people to drugs and to alcohol. And I don't care what race you are or what color you are, that's going to be prevalent universally across the entire world. On the flip side, when I'm producing my wines and when I used to have my own vineyards and grew grapes and the vineyards I work with, there is a relationship between vines and the soil or the vines and terroir that you want to basically, like we have a saying in the wine business, site, soil, clone. So when you're going to plant a vineyard and you choose a site, the first thing is, what soil is it? And those two kind of flip back and forth to why you're going to plant the vineyard, where you're going to plant. And once you have that established, I'm going to be on this site, it's on this soil, then you choose what variety and clone you're going to use. To me, that is working with the land and coaxing the best out of the land, not bending nature to your will, but working with nature and trying to come in balance with what those vines in that place are going to produce. And with that, I think that sensibility I have with nature and my native heritage is, to me, making wine is just an expression of that. So when I'm producing my wine, is, you know, trying to balance that site, soil, and vineyard. And so I feel like in my winemaking, in my experience, in my native sensibilities, I'm trying to coax the best out of those grapes without bending it to my will, but really allowing the soil and the land and that variety to express itself. And I feel like I'm sharing that with other people. So, you know, this notion of making alcohol, I always joke with my kids. They always say, "Dad, you make alcohol." And I say, "No, I don't make alcohol. I make wine." And there's a big difference because feel like what I'm trying to do is art. It's an expression of art. And I'm using grapes and fermentation and barrels to produce that art. I'm not making brandy or cheap whiskey.
No, that's a good answer, and it's very factual because wine does end up in a different category overall. But most importantly, Rob, for our listeners who'd like to learn more about Meillet wine, aren't you proud I got it a second time?
Perfect.
Yeah, I'm impressed with myself. For our listeners who'd like to learn more about Meillet wine online, what is your website?
It's Meillet Wines, MeyeyeWines.com. If you go to the website, there is some email links. Also, we're on Instagram and Facebook, and always drop messages that way as well.
Great. Rob, thank you for making the trip down here to come see me and talk with us today. I think you've opened up some eyes and some minds today.
Great.
Check out the website at meyeyewines.com. Thanks for listening to the longest-running wine podcast online. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2023.